Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to call the meeting back to order. I hope you've all managed to finish dessert. For many years, the chamber had a routine whereby every year we always heard from the commissioner and the mayor and our member of parliament. We're restarting that tradition again tonight, and we have with us our member of parliament, whom I've no doubt is very well known to all of you, but I have had the opportunity to chat with Eric tonight and got some biographical data, which I think is interesting. He was born in Regina, the son of an RCMP officer, and as his name might imply, his forefathers are Danish. He served for 10 years in the Royal Canadian Air Force, during which time, it was from 42 to 52, he served during the war and was decorated with a DFC. While he was also in the Air Force, he took leave without pay and studied for a law degree at Dalhousie University. And he graduated in 1950 while still in the Air Force. Tells me he stuck around for 2 years looking for promotion. Nothing was coming, so he headed north to the land of opportunity, the Yukon. And there he joined a firm of Van Rogan lawyers and practiced together with Mr. Van Rogan, whom some of you might know as now a senator in BC. In 1957, while still a partner of Mr. Van Rogan, he ran for parliament. And after some controversy, and I think contravention is the word, he ran again in 1957, December 16th, and was elected. That's 20 years and one half ago. While a member of parliament, he has acted as shadow in the shadow cabinet, Northern Affairs, Transport, Public Works, Solicitor General. And his present duties encompass special pipeline responsibilities for North and constitutional development. His topics tonight are pipeline, government reform, and the elections ordinance. I think that's about it, Eric. I'd like to introduce you now, Eric Nielsen.
Thank you very much, Ian. I see the scurry of the press, and I don't know why you've kept the lights out here, so I can't see my notes, which I've just written. I am, for the benefit of the members of the media who may be here tonight and who are concerned about accuracy, and I know you all are, I am taping in my little recorder my remarks, and the cassette will be available to any member of the media who wishes to use it. I'm rather paranoid about being quoted accurately. Ian, first I want to thank you and the executive of the chamber for inviting me here tonight to renew a tradition that indeed I remember well when your public representatives were invited to stimulate the thoughts of the chamber in order perhaps sometimes for the better, sometimes not so much for the better, to assist you in your participation in the national work of the Chamber of Commerce, which each year comes forth with a very detailed policy paper on suggestions to the cabinet, and which organization, that is the Canadian Chamber of Commerce, is very influential in the shaping of public opinion where the laws are made. Ladies and gentlemen, I am a politician. I make that admission without shame and very readily. And I want to speak tonight as a politician, but I want to speak in a very nonpartisan way, because what I have to say tonight is intended not to be partisan, but intended to stimulate the kind of thought that I think the chamber should be engaged in grappling with in order to make that kind of national contribution to which I referred a moment ago. Perhaps some of my remarks may appear to those who do not share my political beliefs to be biased, but I say at the outset that they're not intended to so be. I have an honest and sincere desire to expose national and local concerns which should be in my submission of concern to the chamber in its work and should be of concern to the community at large. As Ian has told you, I want to speak about the pipeline, a project with which I have been very intimately and vigorously involved over the last 3 months. And I might say with tongue in cheek here to those that may not believe that I spend too much time in Ottawa, that it comes as rather a reverse form of humor to me to be able to come home on occasion and watch myself on television in Ottawa speaking about whatever the order of the day might be. The pipeline is the one subject. The other subject that I want to address tonight is the reform of government in the Yukon, and thirdly, the passage of the Yukon Elections Ordinance, which paves the way for the introduction in the Yukon Legislative Assembly, which will be elected this fall in October or November, of party politics. And the last, perhaps, is a matter which is of more concern to more people in the Yukon than a good many other subjects that touch your pocketbook and your daily attitudes more intimately. First, with respect to the pipeline, my work commenced with my request of our leader to be relieved of the responsibilities of the in the shadow cabinet of the Solicitor General. I felt that I had completed my work there with a lengthy position paper on penitentiaries policy, which took me to pretty well all of the important places in the Western world and through their penitentiary system, including the United States, for a period of some 8 to 9 months. Secondly, a position paper on the young offenders and the new legislation which is about to be introduced in Ottawa with respect to the method that we will be dealing with young offenders in the future in this country. And fourthly, and not unexpectedly, a position paper which has not been made public yet with respect to, parts of it have, with respect to the other responsibility in the Solicitor General's Department, and that is the RCMP. I asked Joe to be relieved of that position because of the advent of not just the Alyeska pipeline and the Alaska Highway pipeline and the Mackenzie Valley pipeline, but the, as well, Polar Gas Project and the emphasis which was being placed on the exploration for new energy resources. And I had that specific interest, not simply because it was a local interest, but because I have a very personal interest in that theater. The magnitude of the Alaska Highway Pipeline Project itself is rather mind-boggling. And the deeper that myself and my special caucus committee got into it, the more we realized the importance of it to the national economic fabric. It means, as the Deputy Prime Minister has stated in the House of Commons, something in the order of 100,000 man-year jobs in a time of critical unemployment. It means the creation of a new capacity for our steel industry in Canada, both in the East and in the West, where the economic center appears to be gradually shifting, that is, from the East to the West. It means the creation of a pipe manufacturing industry second to none in the world. It means the creation, in essence, of a new and dynamic industry in Canada that will be able to compete worldwide successfully in a highly technical and highly expert industry, namely the building of pipelines. Out of this, on a national, from a national point of view, out of this Alaska Highway Pipeline, I and my colleagues are convinced, and that includes colleagues on all sides of the House, except perhaps the one corner to my left. There is a conviction that out of this project will come the birth of a new Canadian expertise in the rolling of steel and the manufacture of pipe that will be able to compete successfully with any other similar industry in the world. And there are some highly efficient and successful steel industries and pipe mills in places like Germany and Italy and Japan and the United States. So that's the first thing that came across to us in our studies with respect to the pipeline, which incidentally we commenced with groups like Foothills and their operating companies, West Coast Transmission and AGTL, and Canadian Arctic Resources Committee, and many others. I understand that the Alaska Highway Pipeline panel will be here this weekend, and it's my intention to attend, although I haven't been asked to attend, but I certainly will be attending in the hope that I can contribute something to those discussions. The preliminary studies which we made with the cooperation, and it was full cooperation, of Foothills and these other groups I mentioned. Foothills, incidentally, which is spending some $3 million a month before the project even starts, to give you some idea of the investment that's going into the project. We're very educational. And then we got the bill, a bill that, and I don't say this in a critical way, which was introduced in Parliament rather late. The American legislation, similar legislation, was passed in November of the preceding year. It was my feeling that we could have had ours before the Christmas recess. But we got it late after coming back after Christmas, within the week. And it was my determination that as we had worked on the penitentiary subcommittee, where we produced a unanimous report containing a package of recommendations with respect to reform of our system, which we are still convinced will bring about peace in the prison system, chiefly to prevent the hostage-taking incidents and the violence and so on in our prison system. I approached, as chairman of our Caucus Committee, the pipeline with the same attitude. I thought this project was of such magnitude nationally that there had to be unanimity of opinion if it was going to be successful. As a result of that approach, in my 20-odd years in Parliament, for the first time, as the Deputy Prime Minister said on third reading, for the first time in his experience and in my experience, a bill went through a parliamentary standing committee without a single division on a single clause. The whole thing was done by negotiation between myself and Alan McKechnie. This is a plus, and it's unique in that respect. We didn't get all we wanted. They gave more than they wanted to, but we reached a saw. For reasons which I'm not going to belay, it was impossible during the discussion of the bill itself to bring about any change in the cabinet decision as enunciated by the Minister of Northern Affairs on the 14th, that there would only be a $50 million heritage fund established for the Yukon, as opposed to the Lissick recommendation, which recommended a $200 million heritage fund as soon as the as gas flowed, to be supplemented by 50% of the revenues from property taxes, and so build up that fund to provide for the for long-term benefits to the Yukon. I might divert for a moment here and pay a compliment to someone who I don't see here tonight, though he may be, and that is your representative on the Yukon Legislative Assembly, Ken McKinnon, who presented the viewpoint of the Yukon Legislative Assembly, and I insist on calling it that, whatever anyone else insists upon calling it, presented the viewpoint of the Assembly unanimously. He did an excellent job. And if you read the committee reports, which are available at your local Chamber of Commerce office, and if not there, then at my constituency office, you will see that he received nothing but compliments in presenting the Yukon point of view, and the more impressive because it was unanimous. They had to get together too, and I'm sure there were divergent points of view as to what they were going to agree was going to be unanimous and what was not. Point remains that he made the Yukon's position very well and very articulately. The bill, when it came in to Parliament, was extremely deficient. It was alarming to the native population, because nowhere in the bill was there any mention of the native presence. Indeed, nowhere in the bill was there any mention made of the residents who would be affected in socioeconomic terms or in environmental terms over the route that would be traversed by the pipeline. On top of that, there were piled provisions that provided the most sweeping, the broadest powers that I, in my 27 years in the practice of law, have ever seen in any law, in any piece of legislation. The judicial provisions were so constricted as would have denied the traditional freedom of access of the citizen to the courts, which has its roots in our British system. The provisions of the bill provided for no input by Yukoners through their elected representatives or in any other fashion with respect to appointments to be made on consultative and advisory bodies. All of these matters we addressed in committee. We asked for opinions from Foothills and, as I say, from CARC and other bodies and other individuals. Then began the process of negotiation. We were so convincing with respect to our representations concerning the sweeping powers of the ministry that we convinced Mr. McKechnie to drop entirely subsections 1 and 2 of section 16 of the bill, which contained those provisions. We insisted as far back as last August, when the project of the pipeline was first discussed, that there had to be some monitoring control, some control agency. And our suggestion then was the setting up of a parliamentary committee, a special parliamentary committee for performing that function. As a result, our standing orders of the House of Commons are going to be amended to set up a standing committee of the House of 15 members for the purpose of monitoring and reporting to Parliament every 4 months every aspect of the construction of the line, including the socio-economic problems and the environmental problems and so on. We were also successful in amending the bill with Mr. McKechnie's agreement that before any appointment to the federal provincial consultative body that would be set up, that it would be upon the recommendation of the members of your elected members of the Yukon Legislative Assembly. We were also successful in providing that there would be a mandatory advisory council set up for the purpose of primarily conducting a second stage inquiry that was promised by Mr. Lissick and his inquiry repeatedly throughout their hearings, and which, as Mr. McKinnon assured us in the committee, would in its composition include a substantial representation by the native people of the Yukon. The bill is passed. It is now law. But that doesn't mean we're going to get a pipeline. There are so many pieces that still have to fall into place before an Alaska Highway pipeline becomes a reality, that it would be foolhardy for any individual to invest his or her life savings in the speculative process, counting on the absolute assurance that a pipeline is going to be built. The chief criteria that are present in this question as to whether or not the pipeline is going to be built rest first in the passage of President Carter's energy package, which is now before Congress, and there is an alternative there through the federal through FERC, the Federal Energy Reserve Commission in Regulatory Commission in the United States, which is an arbitrary process which I imagine President Carter was very reluctant to adopt. But that has to get through. The price of gas has to be set before any contracts can be let. And Foothills has to obtain the contracts before they can approach their financing. And the financing of a $10 billion project, 4.6 of which roughly is in Canada, poses problems that have not been confronted by any project, I would venture to say, in the world. But at least I'm safe in saying anywhere in the free world. But all of these pieces have to fall in place. In the meantime, there's the so-called gas bubble that now exists in the province of Alberta, and the very real probability of the pre-building of the Alberta section of the pipeline first. And now we are assured in committee and in the House of Commons that will not change the itinerary and the dates that are set forth to be met by Foothills as set forth in the international agreement in terms of the Yukon laying pipe by January 1st, 1981. But if I were a gambling man, which I am not, I would certainly not accept any bets that Alberta pre-build would not delay the Yukon section. The delay is going to be on the tail end, I think. That is, a turn on January 1st, 1983. But delay, I think, is inevitable because it's my assessment that Alberta pre-build will go ahead and will go ahead first. Indeed, there have been contracts already signed with 7 United States utilities to dispose of that a portion of that gas bubble in Alberta, which still have to go through the 2 national regulatory agencies here and in the United States. I want to make it clear here that we supported in my party in the House of Commons the principle of that bill throughout second reading, throughout the magnificent cooperation which You would have thought it was a mutual admiration society to hear McKechnie and myself compliment each other on third reading, much to the chagrin of the people on my left, who voted against the bill, both on second reading and on third. I think there should be an explanation as to why there was that division of opinion in the House of Commons. The government party and our party supporting the bill on the one hand, and along with the Social Credit Party, I might add, and the NDP party not. In the international agreement, there are very admirable intentions spelled out that we should use Canadian labor to its utmost. We should use Canadian productive capacity in the rolling of steel and the production of pipe. But there are no legislative guarantees that this is going to happen. We had evidence, indeed, Mr. Blair at one point said that he expected 100% of the 56-inch pipe to come from Canada, but that 90% was a good target. The doubting Thomases doubted that this target was going to be reached, so they wanted to write into the legislation by amendment a provision which would guarantee that these targets would be met. This was impossible for two reasons: that we had already signed a negotiated agreement with the United States which bound us as a contractual party, and no amendments could be made to the legislation which changed the provisions of that agreement. Secondly, any such amendment would have offended the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades, which gives no favored nation treatment. So the only practical way around guaranteeing that Canadian content was assured, as it was spelled out in the international agreement, was to provide some form of overview. And our suggestion, which was adopted by the Deputy Prime Minister, Mr. McKechnie, was the creation of a special committee of Parliament so that we could once every 4 months report back to Parliament to see that those very admirable Canadian content provisions spelled out in the international agreement were being achieved. Our work, and I will be on that committee when it is formed, will be to act as a watchdog, to speak with the Foothills people, to speak with the labor organizations, to speak with the steel industry, to speak with the pipe industry, and to have them report to us as to whether or not those targets are being met. The Senate has recommended a similar committee, the usefulness of which I rather doubt, because it would be simply a duplication of our own work in the Commons, but anything to keep them busy. Now, if I can pass quickly to government reform. I think everyone that is an active member of the chamber is familiar with the history of the development of our form of government in the Yukon. Certainly you're all familiar with the position that I have taken, and you're all familiar with the questionnaires that I have sent out from time to time. I have been polling this question of governmental reform for some 5 years now. The party that I have the honor to lead at the moment here in the Yukon is committed by a resolution that was passed over 15 years ago, that as soon as we had the numbers which would provide for meaningful division in the Yukon Legislative Assembly, that we should move to party politics. I had nothing to do with the input into the design of the new elections ordinance here in the Yukon, but that has now passed, and it provides for precisely that, because the number of the members who will be elected to your next legislative assembly will be 16. We had set the number at 15 because we felt that this was the only mathematical, practical, meaningful number that that would make any sense, and it followed the Manitoba precedent. We have been told repeatedly, on the one hand, that there is need for political reform in our local institutions and local government in the Yukon, and on the other hand, we have been told by those in power that we needn't expect it. Indeed, we cannot expect it in our lifetime or for a generation. I hold, as do a good many Yukoners, and I say this personally and not as a representative of my party in the Yukon, I hold the belief that all Canadians are entitled to the same rights, the same freedoms, and the same obligations as any other Canadian. I don't hold with the idea that a responsible form of government has a price tag on it, that we must be able to pay the piper before we can call a tune. I don't hold with those who believe that we must have a certain magic number of people in the Yukon before we can enjoy those same rights as others do in other parts of Canada. And indeed, that's the way our country was built. I do hold with those who advocate change, but change can only come about within an established federal framework which has existed for over 100 years and which now cannot be altered in any practical way without the unanimous consent of the whole. So that to try to experiment, which has been seriously suggested in the House of Commons usually by those who have not been north of the 60th parallel, to experiment with change in the hope that you can come up with some new kind of magic formula for the Yukon, or for the Northwest Territories for that matter, within the existing federal framework is begging the question. It can't be done. In hindsight, it's beautiful to be able to have anticipated what has happened 100 years later. If we were the fathers of Confederation when the decisions were made then, we would probably not be 10 provinces and 2 territories, but we would probably be something like 5 geographical, economic, and political regions in the country, which has been suggested commencing, I think, with Premier Patillo in British Columbia in 1935. So that those who tend to now take the heat off of the government reform argument by suggesting some new form of experiment in the North is, for that reason only, I suggest to you. They have lost the economic argument now, because in response to those of us who are vigorously saying that now is the time for reform, which will lead to a fully responsible government, which is synonymous with provincial status, you have to be able to pay your way. Well, now we're on the doorstep, quite apart from my assertion to you that the resource revenues of the Yukon is sufficient to provide us with the economic means of achieving just that now, to the same extent as all of the maritime provinces, and even surpassing PEI and Newfoundland. In a per capita sense, we can do that now. But on top of that, we have an anticipated revenue starting in the early 80s of some $30 million a year, negotiated by Mr. McKechnie with Mr. Schlesinger, a power which he usurped from the Yukon Legislative Assembly, which has exclusive jurisdiction to legislate in this sphere. We don't criticize him or fault him for that, for taking that power away momentarily, because he made a good tax deal for us. But that's an extra $30 million that Yukon never expected. And that puts us, regardless of what papers and what studies are being done now for the purpose of putting down the provincial status argument, papers and studies generated by the federal government, that puts us in a position of being a have area in this country. And I would suggest to you that it would be a have area second only to Alberta and possibly to British Columbia. So the economic argument for government reform falls to the ground. The people argument never was valid, because I repeatedly compare the emergence of the province of Manitoba, which was carved out of the then district of Assiniboia in the Northwest Territories in 1879. They had 1,051 eligible voters federally when they became a province. When British Columbia became a province, they had between 6,000 and 10,000 eligible voters. This federal election, my anticipation is that we will have some 14,000 or 15,000 eligible voters. Always amazes me when this debate arises in the House of Commons to hear the successive ministers of Northern Affairs use the lowest possible population figures for the Yukon, 15, 16, 18,000 DBS figures, when in fact we are a population of 24 or 25,000 people. But when they want to pat themselves on their back for the successful mineral policies or development policies in the territory, then they come up with the great revenues that are being earned by the mineral industry and the fantastic spiral of accelerating revenues because of their beautiful policies. So don't eat either one of those arguments, Elmer, I suggest to you. The fundamental question that one must ask himself or herself is whether we, as Yukoners, are entitled to the same rights and privileges as are enjoyed by every other Canadian. Now I want to say one word about the Native position, vis-a-vis the pipeline bill, vis-a-vis government reform. There was no Native presence, as I said, in the pipeline bill when it came before us. We felt there should be. We amended two portions of the bill which were accepted by the government. One was to inject not only the Native presence in the bill in those areas of Canada which would be traversed by the pipeline, but also all residents of those areas which would be traversed by the pipeline. And I had to come to a crunch decision with respect to my arguments with Tommy Douglas on this point. He said, and he was asserting his party's position when he said so, that they should enjoy, in essence, and I'm paraphrasing, a special position. And my argument was no, because A, the national magnitude of the project is such that it denies any minority group, whether it be the total population of the Yukon or the native population of the Yukon on a racial basis, to stand in the way of a project so vital to the national interest. Secondly, I took the position, which is incidentally our party position, as has been enunciated by our leader on more than one occasion, that there is no reason why negotiations toward a final settlement of native claims cannot go ahead hand in hand with development without the one prejudicing the other. That was the position that we took. The government accepted it and accepted both amendments, writing in a new section in the bill, section 23.1, which guarantees in effect that no interest which the native people might have in the lands over which the pipeline will travel will be in any way affected in a prejudicial way by virtue of the construction of the line. I could go on at some length with respect to the native position, which is exactly the reverse of that position which I have stated that we took, and which the government took in the discussion of this bill. With respect to government and government reform, it appears that the position is polarizing around an urge of the native people of the Yukon to have control over virtually all of their affairs in a very separate way to those of the rest of us living in the Yukon. And I'm not going to slice it up on the basis that 80% of the people in the Yukon are white and 20% are Native. I just say that it is wrong for any government to adopt a policy which can only result in racial divisions along racial lines and in an and in the encouragement of an apartheid situation. We are Canadians, all of us, whether we be of Danish stock or Ukrainian stock or Polish stock or Indian stock. We are Canadians, and we should participate in existing institutions in Canada and change them if we will, but not try to separate into a separate educational system, into a separate village here which will be populated by Native people and some other village populated by whites, a position that would deny participation in the political process. I was met by the charge and committee that I did not represent, as your federal member, the interests of the Native people. I rejected that view. I stated that I may not represent their viewpoint, which I don't, and I have not done so for as many years as I have been stating the problem to them and to other public gatherings such as this. I've always held the view consistently that I have expressed tonight, but that I do represent their interests as their member, as I do the people on my left. And therein lies the distinction. I was so happy to hear, in one sense, that the federal NDP party here in the Yukon had elected a Native candidate. So now I suggest to them, and I'm sorry that none are here tonight, that they are now committed to the very process which has helped to build this nation and this Yukon of ours, and which hopefully will continue. And they will participate, not only at the federal level, but at the territorial level, where they could have won 3 seats at least last election round in 74, and where, as a result of the electoral boundaries redistribution report which has been adopted by our Assembly, they can win at least 5 seats this time around, if they unite and elect their own Native candidate in the understood, duly democratic way. One last thing, and I'm going on a little long, is the introduction, because of the passage of the new elections ordinance, of party politics in your assembly. It's vital. It's important. This is the... This started with Magna Carta. It ended with Hitler. Unless you have the democratic process operating, and I make no excuses for the thumping and the heckling that you're seeing on television these days of members of Parliament and the House of Commons. That's the way things have been going on for centuries. I was astounded when I first went down there and saw it. I'm sure just as astounded as many of you who are seeing it on TV for the first time. I wasn't there today. I would love to have been there today, because I understand there was quite a peaked Prime Minister who left the House as a result of this kind of shouting and heckling. It's the most challenging forensic forum that anyone wishes, who has an interest, to expose themselves to. But it's part and parcel of our history. It's part and parcel of the growth of the democratic process. This violent clash of opinion and views results, hopefully, in good legislation. Winston Churchill said it's for the lack of anything better, it's better than nothing. You know, if we could change it so we could all do it in whispers or like a Sunday school debating society, perhaps that might be better. But by and large, it's the best system that is available. And your members down there are not being irresponsible when they're participating in this kind of conduct. We don't do it in committee. Strangely enough, we heckle and we interject. But the main point here is party politics at the local level. You can't have that violent clash of opinion from which emerges the legislation at the small end of the tube without it. That was the whole idea when Westminster was created. That was the whole idea when the barons told the king he was going to be subservient to the representatives of the people. And it cannot happen in a system such as exists now in the Yukon, where you have, for the most part, your elected representatives constantly in opposition with the bureaucrats, with the civil service. It has to be a situation where you have elected representatives opposing elected representatives, and those elected representatives dictating the policy to the civil servants, and not the reverse. And I don't mean to deprecate any member of the civil service by those remarks. That's simply the core of the system, and it has to work that way. There can be no appointments to democratically functioning boards, cabinets, legislatures. That was done away with in the Northwest Territories a few years ago. And by sheer force of numbers, it's going to happen with respect to the executive committee here. When the council reaches the size of 16, there'll be no more excuse for the prevention or the refusal of a majority-minority situation in your local house. And that is the healthy situation which has to persist. And as briefly as I can, in order for that to persist here, there now have to be laid the foundations by all political parties for creating constituency organizations in the 16 constituencies that are now created by your new elections ordinance. And in each of those constituency organizations, there must be party executives elected, and the people of those constituencies must elect those executives, and they must elect their respective candidates who attend a Yukon Territorial Party Leadership Convention, who will elect their leader, who will either lead a government or lead a minority in your next house. That is a tremendous amount of work. We have started in our party, which is incidentally entirely separate from the federal organization, which is as it should be. And I believe that the first meeting of the people of the seven Whitehorse area constituencies is being held this Saturday. From now on, I'm off my tape, and I hope I'm not misquoted. But that is being held this Saturday. I think it's in the Whitehorse in Bauru. I'm not sure. I'm not sure of the time, but you'll probably see it in your local newspaper. I think it's incumbent upon every politically interested person, as every person in the chamber should be, and I'm not speaking about partisanship now, to arouse themselves, to instill in themselves an interest in the process of change that's going on in the Yukon politically. It's upon you. It's on your doorstep. And if you do not get involved, then you should not be heard to be critical of the results that will be coming from the next territorial election. My wish, my hope, is to see at least two or more strong political organizations at the territorial level, completely separate from the federal level, who will provide the talent that will be governing the Yukon Territory for the next 4 years after the next election. I'm not going to get partisan tonight, but I simply draw your attention to the difference between the two major political parties on the federal scene with respect to their approach to fully responsible government. And they are different positions, and the choice has to be made. On the one hand, there will be no provincial status at all within our lifetime. On the other hand, there's the view that if it is the wish of the people of the Yukon that provincial status be implemented, then it will be. the most misunderstood factor in this whole debate is the economic factor. I can only say to you in the very short time that I have left, indeed I've exceeded it, is that once the debate starts, and it will be assisted by the formation of the political structures I suggest at the territorial level, it will become clear to all that the Yukon economically is in a position to support a provincial status style government, is in a position to support, regardless of the economic arguments advanced by those who oppose the idea, will be in a position to support a fully fledged provincial style government. That debate will arise, I'm sure, during the next 6 to 7 months before your next territorial polling day, and hopefully during that educational process, during that exposure, the majority of the people in the Yukon will come to realize that. I'm sorry to have taken so long. If there are going to be questions, I'd be glad to try to answer them in. And I would like, in closing, simply to thank you for having me as your guest, and I hope that I haven't said anything too partisan to offend anyone.